all know this, but I will tell you anyway, remind you about the timing. While it's green, fine. When it turns yellow, you have 2 minutes. When it turns red, you are done. Unless we're still asking questions, you need to keep answering. But if not, then you're done. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. Case number 24-50128, League of United Latin American Citizens et al. Versus Abbott and a lot of other people. And we will begin with Perales for League of United Latin American et al.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Nina Perales for appellants LULAC et al. I will reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. In Hughes and Betancourt, this court held that the state legislative privilege shields communications between legislators and third parties regarding legislation. The district court here erred by expanding the legislative privilege to cover information that legislators did not create, communicate, or even see because it was in the hands of others. This is not how the legislative privilege works. I'd like to start with jurisdiction. This appeal falls within the collateral order doctrine. The state concedes the first two elements of the collateral order doctrine, the first two Cohen factors, that the orders below can be interpreted as conclusively determining the dispute, and also that it presents important questions that are separate from the merits. The disagreement here is the third element, whether the post-trial review is an effective remedy. As recently as 2022, in the Leonard decision, this court observed that the collateral order doctrine is generally not available for discovery disputes, and that was a case involving a third-party subpoena recipient. But since that time, since 2022, the court in Hughes and then again in Betancourt opened the door to exercising jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine for third-party subpoena recipients. We contend that that door should be open for parties who are denied discovery as well as those who are ordered to disclose it. This court—
Okay, now I think you're well aware that, well, I was a state district judge. I had thousands of hearings on discovery. So obviously those cannot all be appealed until the end of the case. So what is, you know, we can't, just because you are not satisfied with the discovery, you obviously represent a party in the case, and so you could appeal at the final order, even if that meant that a lot of stuff had to get back and back and back. So what is there special about this particular legalist situation that makes it different from the typical, you know, discovery stuff that we won't take up on prior to the final?
Thank you. The court is aware of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2018 in Abbott versus Bettis, in which the Supreme Court found that Texas had unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered redistricting lines and racially gerrymandered Latino population in that. That was 2018. We were unable to get a remedy for that district until 2020. My answer, Your Honor, is that redistricting cases are special because we are on a ticking clock. The maps that are challenged expire at the end of the decade, and if we are not able to get review and get to our remedy, we lose the opportunity. It's effectively extinguished.
What is your best case that you just said that these cases are special? What is your best case, Supreme Court or Fifth Circuit, that allows us to hear, that gives us jurisdiction, in particular, put a finer point on it, gives us jurisdiction to hear an appeal of a discovery order where there's no production ordered and it's a party? Assuming that it is a special type of case, I mean, you have a three-judge panel, if I'm not mistaken. It is a rather unique situation. what case law can we rely on to claim jurisdiction to get to the merits?
I don't have a case that is as specific as the court has asked for, in part because this is a newly evolving area. From 2022, we rapidly go to the Hughes and Betancourt decisions, which were not redistricting cases, but have which really opened the door in a way that it wasn't open before, for third-party subpoena recipients to appeal. The substantial public interest that they claimed was imperiled had to do with disclosing what they believe is legislatively privileged material. What we are arguing is that now that the door is open, that as a matter of fairness, the substantial public interest that we present, which is the potential loss of the ability to get a remedy, should weigh equally in that consideration.
Now, why not just file a mandamus?
Well, as the state observed in their brief, they didn't think that that was going to be effective, and so we chose not to file a mandamus, just as the subpoena recipients in this case chose not to resist and litigate their issues in a contempt proceeding, right, or in Hughes and in Betancourt. We chose to take this interlocutory appeal.
Okay, but if we end up concluding we lack jurisdiction, are you going to seek a mandamus, or what are you going to do?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. We may, depending on the timing of the decision and whether or not our trial has concluded, whether or not our trial, we are set for trial on May 21st next month. Depending on whether our trial court has reached a decision or not, we would have to take it from there. As Judge Engelhardt has observed, this is a three-judge panel. The path from here in terms of an appeal post-trial would be to the U.S. Supreme Court. The last thing that I would note is that in Whole Women's Health, the court talked about the novelty of the questions as weighing in favor of the exercise of jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine. And we believe that the novelty of the questions here, which have to do with the scope of the legislative privilege, is important, and that the district courts do need guidance. Here, the district court radically expanded the scope of the legislative privilege from what we have in Hughes and Betancourt. And because of that, just as in Whole Women's Health, we believe that the court should exercise jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine and clarify for district courts what the scope
is. But if you're having your trial next month, even if we found we had jurisdiction and think you should get a little bit of discovery or something like that, how is that going to work its way through? We don't typically, we're not typically able to send out an opinion by like tomorrow, so you would maybe not get the opinion immediately, even if we ended up deciding we had jurisdiction. So I'm a little bit wondering how that would affect everything.
Your Honor, I think it would depend on the timing of the district court's decision itself. If we are still without a decision from the district court, and certainly the last cycle of redistricting, we filed in the year ending one, we tried the case three times, and eventually ended up with a district court decision in 2017, which was 6 years later. It depends on when the district court renders its decision. If we have the opportunity to do a supplemental hearing and include that in the original record, we would seek to do that. And
okay.
So the court has the full material before it. Without any further questions, I'd like to turn to the merits.
All right.
The state legislative privilege is not an endless game of telephone that shields information a legislator never saw because it was in a conversation of a strategist who talked to a lobbyist, who talked to a staffer who worked for the legislator. The state legislative privilege is qualified and it must be strictly construed. The scope of the legislative privilege shields information that reflects legislators' actions in the proposal, formulation, and passage of legislation. These are the legislators' thoughts and words and communications. Even though federal courts are sensitive to interfering with the functioning of state legislators, First, there is not a separation of powers issue with respect to the state legislative privilege, because federal courts and state legislatures are not co-equal branches of government. But going over to the consideration that federal courts have for the workings of state legislators, it doesn't create the type of unbounded state legislative privilege without limiting principles for scope and waiver that we have in the district court decision. And most important, the scope of the legislative privilege is not reverse engineered from what is relevant to plaintiffs' claims. That's exactly backwards from the way that the privilege works, because it's personal to legislators. Hughes talks about the legislative privilege as shielding legislator communications with third parties because, quote, lawmakers routinely meet with persons outside the legislature, right, to discuss issues that bear on potential legislation. The district court erred here by shielding information that did not involve the legislators and thus does not reflect their actions or communications. In fact, in some situations, third-party custodians sequestered the information from legislators. In that situation, they cannot assert the legislative privilege. So, for example, the 795 documents created by the Office of the Attorney General, the privilege logs say that these materials were never shared with legislators, and the privilege logs do not say that the information in the documents were ever shared with legislators. Another example are redistricting maps and data in the computer of the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, which the district court correctly concluded, who is a member of the executive branch, and there was no claim that this member of the executive branch ever shared this information with a legislator. And then finally, the same for redistricting steps taken by a map drawer for a lobbyist for members of Congress. That was never shared with a legislator. There's another scope error in the district court's decision, and that has to do with timing. The scope of the legislative privilege cannot encompass information that was generated following enactment of the challenged legislation. Talking about legislation, even a lawmaker talking about legislation after it is passed, as we understand from Hughes, is not related to the proposal, formulation, or passage of legislation. Finally, we'd like to highlight several ways in which the court erred when it said that the legislative privilege is not waived. First of all, the court did not address the argument that some of this legislative privilege was waived as to testimony involving Mr. Adam Kincaid, because it was not objected to in an earlier deposition where the lobbyist testified on the same topics. The legislator's counsel was there, did not object. But then in a later deposition in which the same material was covered, the legislator sought to object and assert the legislative privilege. We believe that waiver is present in that situation, and the district court did not address it. Second, the district court created a test for waiver that cannot be squared with Hughes. Hughes says that the legislative privilege is waived when it's shared with a third party outside the legislative process. The district court here said waiver only occurs when the legislator makes the information publicly available. And that is a very different test and much too broad for the limits that were presented by Hughes. The district court said that the general public has to have access to the information in order for waiver to occur. And that is that basically shields information shared with an unlimited number of people as long as it's just short of the general public. Finally, while recognizing that making information public does waive the privilege, the district court erred by holding that selective public disclosure by legislators did not waive the privilege. Legislators claimed publicly to have engaged in a race-blind map drawing process, that they relied on certain specific data, and that they confirmed the compliance of their maps with the Voting Rights Act. But then when we asked them questions about those very same public statements, they asserted the legislative privilege in their depositions. And it is our contention that by talking about the process in such detail publicly, that constitutes waiver. If the court has no additional questions.
Okay, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right, we'll now hear from William Cole for the defendant, appellees.
Thank you, Judge Haynes, and may it please the court. And let me start with jurisdiction because I think it is dispositive and probably the most straightforward way for the court to resolve this case. There is no jurisdiction under this case under the collateral order doctrine, focusing on the third element of the Cohen test, whether the district court's order is effectively unreviewable on appeal from final judgment. As you note, they are parties. They can appeal after the final judgment. That's what Mohawk said. Party status is important. And the argument I heard from my friend on the other side is that, well, Betancourt and Hughes opened the door. Well, they did not. I'll quote you from Hughes because I think it's a very important line. When we're talking about the class of orders, and again, that goes back to Mohawk 2, when we're looking at the collateral order doctrine, it's on the class of orders. The class consists solely of claims from non-parties who lack appellate remedies available to the contenders in litigation. That's it. Of Hughes. That is the class we're talking about, non-parties who are denied legislative privilege. As you say, they are parties. So that means they can appeal the judgment just the same as anyone, and they can get a new trial if it was prejudicial and it was an error. So in our view, that resolves the case. You can just dismiss on collateral order doctrine grounds because that is dispositive. I'm not aware.
But does timing matter here? Your opponent suggested that it does. Because of, you know, voting and things like that. And also legislators in and out and this and that. And so it's a little bit different from a typical case, like I said, when I was a state district judge hearing thousands of hearings about discovery. Obviously, those can't all be appealed. And we are not saying that. So I'm just wondering, is there something cubbied here with a three-judge panel at the district court with the fact that it involves legislatures and so on, and the timing?
No, I'm not aware of any case that says that makes this timing relevant. They certainly didn't ask the trial court to stay the trial pending this appeal. Like, they could have done that, I suppose. They didn't do that at the status conference for trial about a month ago. I mean, actually, the state legislator said you should give us more time to get ready for trial because it's a pretty quick trial schedule. But again, they didn't do that. They haven't asked this court to do that, so I don't see how the timing is relevant. I'll note this case has been pending since 2021. They didn't amend their complaints until a couple weeks ago, I think. It might have been last week or 2 weeks ago. So if timing is suddenly an issue, I'm not sure how that squares with their litigation conduct. But to go directly to your question, no, I'm not aware of any case that says timing, that there's some timing element that turns on the application of the Cohen factors. Certainly Hughes didn't suggest that. Betancourt didn't suggest that. Mohawk doesn't suggest that. Whole Woman's Health versus Smith doesn't suggest that. Again, I think the key point here is that it's the party status that is relevant. And here again, they are parties, not non-parties. In the cases where they say they opened the door, the court was very clear, both in Betancourt and in Hughes, that it was the fact that they're non-parties that makes the order in those cases effectively unreviewable on appeal from final judgment.
And so it doesn't matter that it's a three-judge panel or that these are legislators that could be in and out and all kinds of stuff could be hard to find if we waited for the trial and then they appealed and so on down the road?
I'm not aware of any case that says the collateral order doctrine turns on whether it's effectively unreviewable, turns on whether or not it's a three-judge panel. I've never seen that case. That's new.
Okay, but what about legislature?
What about the legislator?
Yeah, the fact that they can be in and out. They get elected, they get unelected, they move in, they move out. It's a little different animal than the typical discovery cases.
Again, I don't see any case that says that is relevant to this procedural appellate jurisdiction question about the collateral order doctrine. The focus is not on who's the recipient of the discovery. It's whether the order at issue is effectively unreviewable on appeal from final judgment. That's Cohen factor three. And here it is. They can appeal once they get a final judgment. And that is the test. Again, we're talking about a class of orders, not the recipients of the subpoenas. The class of orders, again, consists solely, as the unanimous court said in Hughes, of claims from non-parties who lack the appellate remedies. They have the appellate remedies because they are parties. And Mohawk again says, the remedy is you seek a new trial if it's prejudicial. So again, we think you can stop there and resolve this case on jurisdictional grounds. I will briefly touch on the merits. We think this case is resolved completely by Hughes and Betancourt. Twice in the last 2 years, this court has affirmed and reaffirmed that the scope of the legislative privilege is necessarily broad, and it covers legislators' actions within the sphere of legitimate legislative activity, meaning their activities in the course of the proposal, formulation, and passage of legislation. This court's in good company on that because it's joined at least three of its sister circuits at 1.4 in recognizing that scope. And appellant's arguments on the merits here are simply a full frontal attack on Hughes and on Betancourt. Judge Smith, writing for the district court, properly rejected that, and this court should too, because the rule of orderliness compels it. And their arguments come back to scope, waiver, and yield, which are the three buckets that Hughes cited. We think all of those attacks fail. On the scope issue, this difference between factual and non-factual materials, I'll say at the outset, to accept their argument would require the court to create a circuit split where there is none with Purnell in the 11th Circuit. But more broadly, the legislative privilege protects the entire sphere of legitimate legislative activity. And as Judge Smith rightly noted for the three judge panel at ROA 23581, disclosing that a legislator relied on or considered some facts and not others would inevitably indicate their legislators' deliberations.
Counsel, can you reconcile Hughes and the Jefferson Community Health Care Center case?
Yes, I can. The answer is that the Jefferson Community Health Care case says that you cannot use the legislative privilege to bar adjudication of a claim. That was the holding of Jefferson Community Health Care Centers. And Hughes is about evidence, about documents, and that's exactly what Hughes said. So I know that they, as I said just a few minutes ago, their arguments are essentially taking on Hughes, taking on Betancourt and saying you should ignore them and follow Jefferson. It's not how the rule of orderliness works. This court in Hughes specifically rejected the argument that Jefferson was relevant, and so this panel would be bound by that. To be sure, I understand they disagree with Hughes, they disagree with Betancourt, but what they should do then is ask the en banc court for review or ask the Supreme Court to take it up on a cert petition. But asking this court to essentially flout the rule of orderliness by ignoring it, by following Jefferson, I don't think would be appropriate under the rule of orderliness there. So Jefferson, I think, again, it's about barring adjudication of a claim. That was the holding. And you have a paragraph in Jefferson about the legislative privilege, and the last sentence is what's relevant. It says, at any rate, even assuming the council members' reasons for passing the resolutions are privileged in the sense that they can't be compelled to disclose them, this evidentiary privilege cannot bar adjudication of a claim. And again, the unanimous panel in Hughes already said that is only about barring adjudication of a claim. Rule of orderliness would compel the court to follow that. They talk a lot about sharing documents with third parties. That's Betancourt. So they say, well, someone else, they didn't see it or something like that. Well, Betancourt said as long as the person is brought into the legislative process, the privilege is broad and covers them. So we think that's rejected by Betancourt. And the same is true of their sort of custodian argument. Enactment period, this is all, again, part of their attack on scope. The enactment period, I think, misunderstands how the legislative process works. The legislative process, the legislature in Texas is biennial, it meets every 2 years, but they're working, even outside of the six or so month period that they're not working. So it's not like it's only the period in which the legislature's in session that the privilege covers. That's just not how the modern legislative process works. Waiver, touched on it briefly. Again, when Betancourt resolves this, third parties are involved. They can be involved if they're brought into the process. I'll point to the Hilstoski case on waiver from the Supreme Court. They say, well, you know, if you testified in a deposition, that should waive it. Well, Hilstoski says it needs to be clear and unequivocal waiver, and in that case, the representative testified about 7 to 10 times in a grand jury, and the Supreme Court said not good enough. It's not a waiver. So we think that takes care of waiver. The last thing is this yield issue, and we think Betancourt resolves that. I think they say in their brief that the three-judge panel kind of created this tripartite test. Well, that is the law of the circuit under Betancourt that Judge Smith wrote in Betancourt and then applied in this order on appeal here. So it talks about whether the civil case, this is an extraordinary civil case. Lee from the Ninth Circuit says it's not. The In Re North Dakota Legislative Assembly case says it's not. That was GVR'd after the Supreme Court, but I think it is probative. And so, in sum, in order to accept their arguments on the merits, you would have to not only flout Hughes, not only flout Betancourt, but you would have to create a circuit split where there is none from the 9th, from the 11th, twice, the 1st, and the 8th, which is GVR'd, but I think it is probative on that. If there are no further questions, I'll yield back my time, but happy to take them.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. We'll now hear the rebuttal.
Thank you. Just to correct the record in a couple of aspects, my friend Mr. Cole said that state legislators did not ask for more time prior to the trial. That's not correct. State legislators are not parties in this lawsuit. They're third-party subpoena recipients. Defendants, the state of Texas and Governor Abbott, did note to the court that we were set on a very fast timeline for a trial, and I think everybody, including the judges in that case, understand that. Second correction, we did not wait to amend our complaint until last week. The court invited the plaintiffs to update their complaints given the passage of time from the filing of this case in 2021 to our trial setting in 2025, specifically to update things like changes in census data and election data. This is very typical in redistricting cases. The LULAC plaintiffs thus filed their fifth amended complaint in the litigation last week. Non-parties do not lack remedies when they are ordered to produce discovery. They can resist the discovery and litigate contempt. But as Judge Haynes pointed out in her dissent in Leonard, sometimes the door should be open to interlocutory review. And we contend that we fall into that space. Mohawk from the US Supreme Court says that disclosure of privileged information isn't enough to tip the scales towards interlocutory review under the collateral order doctrine. There has to be something more. Hughes and Betancourt found that something more in the substantial public interest that they identified with disclosure of claimed legislatively privileged materials. We present the substantial public interest that is imperiled by losing the ability to gain a remedy in this case through the delay of having to litigate this issue after the trial. Again, we would point the court's attention to Whole Women's Health, which observed that the need for clarification by this court for district courts on novel questions should weigh in favor of review. My friend Mr. Cole has described Jefferson in the answer to your question, Judge Engelhardt, about how you square Jefferson Community Health and Hughes. And we are not arguing here that Hughes and Betancourt are wrongly decided. What we are arguing is that the district court went way, way, way beyond that. But just focusing on Jefferson and Hughes, my friend says that Jefferson was just dicta and you should ignore it. But Hughes itself, when it discussed the scope of the legislative privilege, was also essentially doing that with dicta, because in Hughes, the parties agreed and the district court had ruled that the materials were legislatively privileged, that they fell within the scope, right? And the question in Hughes was waiver, not scope. So to the extent that Jefferson doesn't have binding language about scope, neither does Hughes. But we believe they're both helpful. In Jefferson, the privilege is described as qualified and strictly construed. And in Hughes, the privilege, and also in Betancourt, the privilege is described as something that protects information exchanged by a legislator directly with another person. In both Hughes and Betancourt, whether it was scope or waiver, it had to do with a direct communication with a third party that had been brought in to the process. Hubbard and Purnell, the two 11th Circuit cases, also dealt with material in the custody of legislators involving something they had generated, seen, discussed. That is not what we have here. Finally, as to the ruling on timing and material created post-enactment, my friend has said that legislators are working after they pass legislation. Of course they are working, and they are very hardworking people, but they are not working on that legislation. And statements and communications that they have regarding legislation that is already enacted, already sent to the governor for his signature, are not covered by the privilege. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We appreciate both sides. The case is now under submission. Thank you.